Welcome. You are listening to Our Burning Questions, a professional learning podcast where we love to talk about teaching multilingual learners. I'm your host, Colette Ferrone Goodwin, and I'm a resource specialist on the ENL team with the Mid-State Regional Bilingual Education Resource Network at OCM BOCES in Syracuse, New York. Thanks for joining us. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Our Burning Questions. Our burning questions for today are, why does leadership matter when supporting ELLs? And what role must administrators play in ensuring that advocacy and equity are manifested in the classroom? And here with me today to talk about these questions, to respond to these questions, is Dr. Diane Sterfenner. Diane, welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I'll just kind of reintroduce myself if you didn't happen to join us for the first podcast. I'm Dr. Diane Sterfenner, and I'm president of Support Ed, and we're a woman-owned small business located outside of the Washington, D.C. metro area, and our focus is on supporting and empowering English learners and their families and their educators. So I'm a former ESOL teacher. I spent the majority of my time in Fairfax County, Virginia. And I've also been in the central office as the ESOL assessment specialist in that district. We're the 10th largest district in the US. And I did want to say before we get started, we are not wearing masks. We were both checked in with each other. We're both fully vaccinated. So feeling more and more comfortable these days.
Yes, yes, absolutely. All right, thank you. Thank you. So, and also just to reiterate, Diane is joining us for part two. So we had a part one. So in case you didn't join us for part one, please check that out as well. Let's see. Let's start our conversation. So my first question is, and because we, you know, a lot of times have listeners who are maybe not familiar with working with English language learners. So to start, I would love for you to just share what makes teaching ELLs different from teaching non-ELLs?
Great. No, that's a great question to get started with. And, you know, as we do get started, I also want to point out that there are many terms to describe our students, right? Some people use English learners, some people say English language learners, some people say multilingual learners or emergent bilinguals. I'll just be probably saying ELLs or English learners or ELs. So what's different about teaching ELLs? There's a lot that's different. Some people, there's a misnomer that it's just good teaching, which is not entirely true. We do draw from a lot of the best practices of engaging all of our learners, but specifically for English learners, we want to call it good teaching plus, as there's been some research done and that term was coined. We want to look at, for example, scaffolding instruction for our English learners, knowing where they are and what they bring and drawing from their assets. So knowing, for example, what's their home language literacy, what kind of education might they have had in their home language. We also want to look at where they are in terms of English language proficiency, what level are they at to be able to differentiate scaffolds for them. We want to look at what type of, you know, environment they're in right now. Are they in a dual language program, for example? How are they being provided English language instruction? And we always want to make sure that we're integrating culturally responsive teaching into instruction for our multilingual learners or English learners. So those are a few things to get started with. Yeah. It's not everything, but it's a good start.
Right. Because we know that there are a lot of factors to consider when working with English language learners, and it's really important to keep those things in mind when working with them. Mm-hmm. So in terms of a Gen Ed content area classroom, what does effective teaching look like for English language learners?
Right, there can be many things to look for. In our work and Support Ed, we've developed a lot of look for tools that are aligned with some of our books. One of the books is Unlocking English Learners' Potential, and so we've developed look for tools aligned with different facets of instruction. So some things to keep in mind and what effective teaching might look like, it would vary widely depending on the class, the content, what are your goals and your objectives, what's the makeup of the class. But some things that we would want to look for example, are ensuring that English learners are involved in oral language discussions. looking at research in that area. It's research from 1996, but it was found that for elves, they only speak about 2% of the class time, which is, you know, just abysmally low, right? So we want to make sure that we are providing supports and scaffolds so that they can engage in academic discussions, which are so important for them to acquire content and language simultaneously. We want to see that they're working in small groups, that they're set up for success, that we're using, for example, sentence frames, sentence starters, they're familiar with school routines. We also want to see, ensure that they can kind of see themselves in the materials used. Are we integrating multicultural texts with them, multilingual text, for example, so they can see their home language elevated and leveraged? We want to see that teachers are scaffolding instruction for them, so providing supports that they might need, for example, sentence frames, sentence starters, graphic organizers. Also, a type of scaffolding is instructional scaffolds, or what the teacher might be doing when instructing, for example, pre-teaching vocabulary or modeling, rephrasing directions, restating, slowing down the pace a little bit, but not watering it down. So those are, there's so many things that we can be doing right in terms of effective instruction.
And that visual support is really important as well, right?
Absolutely.
To make the connections, absolutely.
Right, right. Providing images or the visuals are so key, absolutely.
Yes, okay, great. So I want to kind of shift a little bit because this episode is about leadership. So if you could just talk about how leadership and advocacy are different, how they differ between teachers and building or district leadership.
Right, and there's a lot to unpack there. That's a great question. So I do want to start off by acknowledging first that teachers are leaders as well. So when I became certified as a teacher, I didn't think of myself as a leader at all, but it really is so important and so powerful and such an integral part of what we do. So, you know, first of all, recognizing that teachers are indeed leaders, although they might not always think of themselves as such. And of course, administrators are leaders as well. So the leadership can really differ depending on the context. You know, what an administrator might be doing might be not apparently visible by teachers all of the time. Teachers might not be aware of all the great things administrators might be doing to try to advocate, for example, for English learners and for their teachers, advocating at the building level and at the district level, maybe at the state level as well. So some of that work kind of takes place behind the scenes sometimes. And on the flip side, administrators might not be aware of what teachers are doing as leaders to advocate for their students, for example.
And you asked how advocacy and leadership are different?
How they differ between amongst teachers and the building and district leaders.
Right. So hopefully I kind of, you know, alluded to that in my response. Yeah, so they can be different, but there are definitely areas of overlap. And maybe a little bit later on, I'll talk about a few areas of leadership.
Yeah, absolutely. Great. So one of the roles of an administrator, obviously, is to evaluate teachers and, you know, the quality of their teaching. So what would an administrator look for during an observation that would indicate that teachers are instructing elves effectively?
Right. And I also want to, yeah, that's great. You know, so you did mention teacher evaluation and observation. Mm-hmm. I would definitely, you know, teacher evaluation is a very hot topic these days, especially, you know, in the pandemic and what that might look like. So I would first advocate for frequent observations that are not part of the evaluation process. There are so many look-fors, but I would recommend not having just a laundry list of them, really being specific and intentional about what you're looking for and ensuring that you have a conversation with teachers in terms of what that might look like in the classroom. You know, I've worked with teachers before who have said, unfortunately, my administrator just didn't they had this list, you know, to look for. And what I was doing wasn't on the list, so I was marked down. I was seen as not being an effective teacher because what they were doing with elves was different and not on, you know, the pre-approved list. So I would want to ensure that teachers are involved in the observation process, in the evaluation process, giving their input in terms of what, you know, what really could be an effective look for. So, you know, it would depend, and you getting to your question now, it would depend on what's being taught, what the objectives are. What are your content objectives? What are your language objectives? And again, really kind of whittling it down to what you're hoping to see? You know, are you, and also keeping it very student-centered, what are the students doing? How much are they interacting with each other? How are they interacting with the teacher? Do they feel comfortable, for example? Are they taking risks? So, you know, we could look at lots of different look fors, but, you know, being very intentional and specific about, you know, making sure they're aligned with the content and the objectives of the lesson.
I know, and I was just thinking about, you know, that checklist that you talked about. And, you know, a lot of times it can be so prescriptive. Yeah. And so, you know, and a lot of times maybe the administrators are just not familiar with anything outside of that list. And so, you know, it's really important to kind of, you know, leverage the expertise of the ENL teacher.
Right. And it really speaks also to making sure administrators are involved in professional development, are involved in these conversations. Yes. And how do we do that? I think that might be something we hit on later in our conversation today. But yeah, a lot of times administrators also haven't had the training on, you know, what does it take to be an effective teacher of English learners? So we want to be sure that they're brought into those critical conversations as well. Yeah.
So feeding off of, you know, perspective, because we talked about, you know, perspective, right, on the teacher's part, on the administrator's part. Mm-hmm. To give us some context, can you tell us about the concept of assets-based versus deficit mindset with regard to English language learning?
Sure, and that's, you know, that's really one of the threads that kind of weaves its way through a lot of my work with English learners and their teachers, is we always want to focus on what the students bring, on their assets. So on all of the, you know, the gifts and the talents and the language and culture that they bring, instead of focusing on, you know, what's a perceived lack of what they don't have. So, you know, we always focusing on, you know, what do they bring to the conversation and highlighting that. None of us likes to hear about what we're lacking, right? So especially for an English learner, you know, they used to be called limited English proficient. So that term in and of itself is very deficit based. So, you know, always highlighting the assets and finding out what they are, finding out what motivates students, what interests them. We all have an asset, you know, it might not be uncovered yet. And that's also a reason why we called our previous book Unlocking English Learners' Potential, is because they do come with such potential. And it's sometimes, you know, up to the teacher to try and figure out what that potential is and how to bring it out.
Yeah, and just like, you know, that moving from away from limited English proficiency in New York State, we refer to English language learners in the program as English as a new language, and mm-hmm. multilingual learners, because, you know, English may not be their first language. So even moving away from English as a second language,
right,
to English as a new language is, you know, shifting from that that deficit mindset into mm-hmm. the asset based.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. And that's why I do love the term, you know, multilingual learner, mm-hmm. because it recognizes, you know, when I was in the classroom, some of my students spoke like 5 or 6 languages. Yeah. And they were just super humble about it, like it wasn't a big deal, but I'm like, that's a superpower. Yeah, you gotta,
absolutely,
you know, capitalize on that.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely, that's amazing. In terms of messaging, what kinds of messages do administrators have to send to create a culture that's conducive to L achievement in their district or school building?
Right, and there's so much in terms of messaging that we're unaware of, that we're sending, right? So first of all, being consistent in the messaging, and of course, having a positive message to begin with, you know, the message of the assets, a message of collaboration, but again, that consistency and being unwavering in support of English learners. Really, administrators do so much to set the tone. And with so many things going on, and especially this year, it might be challenging for English learners or multilingual learners to be at the top of anyone's list. We're all, you know, in that kind of fight or flight mode. We have been. So really being intentional, about what message you're sending, what your tone is. Also looking at what are the nonverbals, right? What kind of nonverbal communication are you exhibiting? How do you position yourself? What's your body language look like when you're working, you know, it's that first PD back, right? Before the school year starts with all of your teachers. What are you doing to set the tone and really reflecting on that before you go in? You know, we've had so much of our interactions over Zoom and on digital platforms, And we're all kind of zoomed out, which is why it's so nice to be here face-to-face for once. It's like my first real face-to-face interaction. It's great.
Me too.
So, you know, looking at when we're on those Zoom meetings, just recognizing also all of the hard work everyone's putting in, beginning from a place of grace with students and with teachers, and recognizing we're all doing our best. We're all, you know, trying to support students in the ways that we can. And so recognizing this collaboration and this commitment is going to be really crucial for administrators, especially as we reframe things going into the new school year.
Right. Yeah, and so kind of leading into that is if and because we're transitioning back from the remote learning to in person, and some schools may still be doing a version of hybrid.
Right.
What are some of the first steps that administrators might need to take in order to ensure that this happens?
The transition to in person.
Yes.
Yeah, so it happens successfully. Yeah, especially where our multilingual learners are involved. We want to first. Do a little, get a read of the room, take a needs assessment. So talk to teachers, but also talk to parents and talk to the students themselves. Like, that's so critical. We often leave their voices out of the conversation. Talking to the students themselves, of course, with an interpreter in a socially distant and safe way to find out what's worked for them. How are they feeling as they're coming back to an in-person setting? And we also want to take a look at the social emotional aspects of all of this, making sure, after we have a sense of where are we, what's going on, and involving teachers, of course, in this critical conversation, and ENL teachers, they're usually the ones who have their finger on the pulse of what's happening with their families, which families are struggling, which families are doing okay. So really ensuring that you have this needs assessment, not just looking at test scores, because the validity, that's all called into question big time this year, of course. So really having a sense of holistically, are we looking out for our students' well-being to the degree we can be as we move forward, and really involving these stakeholders in the conversations about opening up schools in person. They've been open this whole time. That's been a criticism, right? If you're looking at social media, people are, of course, saying open the schools. Well, they've been open. They've been open, and their teachers are working, working their tails off to ensure this happens.
So in terms of when thinking about like a system or an action plan, because you talk about that in your book, about having a system and creating an action plan, what aspects of instruction and culture must be addressed for creating that action plan to implement a system that's focused on equity and L achievement?
Right. So you mentioned having an action plan. Sometimes they're called an English learner master plan. Sometimes districts might call them action plans. We actually, we're here in Syracuse, New York today. We actually, Support Ed worked with Syracuse City School District to develop their first English learner master plan. Well, ELL, MLL, they call it master plan. And we were, just super happy to be involved in that. We've also worked with Los Angeles Unified School District on revising theirs as well, and some other districts like Reading in Pennsylvania and Jefferson County in Kentucky. So looking at what are some components that are critical, it's doing this needs assessment, first of all, figuring out who your stakeholders are going to be, making sure you have voices from students, from parents, from all different kinds of teachers, and also from the community. So bringing in community leaders, religious leaders, for example, community partnerships, who you're working with in your community to support English learners. You can look, for example, at your programs. So what kind of programs are you providing to students? Are you in an area where you can provide dual language support, which is, of course, the top model that the research bears out? That's what we really want to provide as to the degree possible. And of course, New York has laws around that. Many other states don't. So it's great that you do have that on your side. Looking, in terms of what type of population do you have? Do you have a low incidence population? In those cases, and in any case, you'd want to look at how you're scheduling your students. What teachers are you putting them with? How are you grouping them? It's often best not to just sprinkle your English learners throughout multiple teachers. It's better to try to group them to the degree possible with teachers who are either duly certified, that would be the top way to do it, or teachers who have had some kind of training or who are willing to collaborate and to learn would be also ideal. And your question was about instructions?
The aspects of instruction and culture and, you know, and how that's involved in that action plan.
Right. Yeah, we want to, you know, so in terms of instruction, you know, getting the program set up is so critical. And the instruction, of course, and looking as you're doing this, looking at your data, you know, not only your, you know, test data and how your students are doing in terms of proficiency, but also data on their inclusion in programs such as gifted and talented, special ed, how they're doing in terms of graduation. How do they do after they exit from services? So I always advocate for this, to take a look after, when you have former or exited English learners, many, many times they outperform native English speakers, which is so amazing. We often don't follow them long term to see that. But with ESSA, this is something we're tracking now. So it's going to be really interesting to see as more districts collect that kind of data. And in terms of integrating culture, for example, in our work with the Reading School District in Pennsylvania, they have, I can't remember the titles, but within the district, they have like cultural officers. I can't think of specialists that were an integral part of our team in coming up with their EL master plan to ensure that we're embedding threads of culture and positive culture. Having students identify with their home cultures as part of instruction is also very key. And speaking of culture, we do, you know, our latest book is Culturally Responsive Teaching for Multilingual Learners, Tools for Equity. We have a lot of checklists and look-fors there in terms of the degree to which schools and districts are providing culturally responsive teaching. Are you setting the tone when students walk into the building? Are they seeing their home languages, flags from, you know, their countries or their parents' or grandparents' home countries? Are they seeing that reflected, for example?
You know, it makes me think, and it also makes me think of a couple of resources that you have on your website, too. You have a culturally responsive website. You have a culturally responsive checklist. Mm-hmm. That would be helpful tools, and we can certainly share.
Oh yeah, that'd be great.
Those tools to, you know, for as a reference.
Right, right. And our checklist is pretty extensive. So that checklist is framed around our 5 guiding principles for culturally responsive teaching. But I would, you know, recommend kind of looking at one component at a time, not everything at once, and just prioritizing, you know, what would you want to focus on and where can you have the opportunity to make an impact.
I'd also like to congratulate you and your team for making the bestseller list on your book as well.
Yeah,
we had no idea in terms of the timing, but I think people are they're ready to hear this message of culturally responsive teaching and how important it is. And we also go into some, you know, what does it mean to be an anti-racist, which also, you know, the timing of that, fortunately and unfortunately, is people seem to be more open to exploring what this means. We've all been kind of cooped up for the past year, and I think people are ready to advocate for multilingual learners in many ways. So that'll be... it'll be an exciting new year. And also with the pandemic, I feel like we've been forced to innovate. Like, think of all we've learned, right, over the past year, just with technology alone, that we would have never learned this otherwise. So we're kind of, you know, in a way being forced to come up, be even more creative than we were in the past, and even more flexible. And so I see the next year is really an opportunity. And I'm very hopeful that our kids, our English learners and multilingual learners will be included even more in instruction.
Yeah, because if nothing else, I think it's definitely brought that inequity to the surface.
Absolutely.
After this past year.
Yeah, it's exacerbated what was already, you know, the cracks that were already there have been blown open for many more people to see.
Right. Yeah. Thinking about that new normal, you know, because, I mean, what is normal now?
Right,
as opposed to then?
Here I am panicking kind of and sitting so close to someone that's not in my family without a mask, but we're vaccinated, but still in my brain, it's so hard to, you know, to make that leap.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, I wanted to just take a little bit of time to kind of go through the 10 keys for your L master plan.
Oh, sure.
You've created a graphic, and it actually goes into more detail in the book as well. So the first one is identification process. So could you maybe just elaborate on what you mean by that, and, mm-hmm. and what's the importance of that?
Right. So first and foremost, we need, you know, when we talk about having a master plan, we want to make sure that we are identifying our English learners. How are they identified? Are they all getting the home language survey? What, when they register for the school district, are they, you know, is the message getting out at each of the schools? Because many times when you go to register, the first person you talk to is your school administrative assistant. And there can be high turnover, and sometimes they're not always getting the message that everyone has to get a home language survey. And I remember my former ESL director, Teddy Prideris in Fairfax County, she told the story. She's a native Greek speaker. Mm-hmm. She brought her kids in to register them for school at the time, speaking to them only in Greek, mm-hmm. was never given a home language survey. So these are, you know, these things can happen that we're missing some of our kids. So we have to be sure that we have a sound way to identify them and also to encourage them to take part in ESOL or ENL services. And that policy varies state by state, and I know New York State, you're not able to opt out. Yeah. Most of the states you are, you can opt out of services, and that can be problematic because then later, if parents choose to opt out, then it comes third grade where they're taking, you know, state mandated content assessments, so they can then, you know, it can become apparent that they might have needed the services that they weren't provided.
Yeah. And for our listeners that live in New York State and work in New York State, our version of that is the home language questionnaire,
right?
Which is translated into several different languages, mm-hmm. now, so that, you know, parents do, yeah. have access to it.
Right.
So yeah. So the next part is program models. So I'm thinking that's more like our version of English as a new language, bilingual education.
Right. So looking at what kind of model are you using? Are you, you know, do you have a dual language program or a bilingual program? You know, are you co-teaching? Mm-hmm. So, you know, the co-teaching model is really gaining a lot of traction these days. So, just looking what kind of model do you have? What's your population like? And that's going to drive the model that you're using. And to what degree are you drawing from research in choosing your program models?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then, of course, you know, making the connection back to New York State, you know, we have, you know, like the regulations state,
right.
you know, you have to have a certain number of English language learners with the same home language, mm-hmm. to start the bilingual education program. So
right, and then you have to find qualified teachers, which, yeah. is very, very tricky.
Yes.
Yeah, it can be. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's one thing I would advocate for, looking to former students from your district who are bilingual and keeping track of them and encouraging them to consider teaching as a profession while they're in school.
Yeah.
So yeah, you have great resources, you know, locally a lot of times, but we really have to learn how to tap into them.
Right, yes.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so the third one is assessment. So what aspects of assessment do districts have to look at?
Oh, there's so many aspects of assessment. This could be a separate, you know, a separate podcast completely. But, you know, looking at how are teachers developing formative assessments? Are they scaffolded? But also, how are L's included in content assessments? What supports are they given? What accommodations are they allowed? Different states use different terms, you know, for these, for what kind of supports they can get. How are you using the results? What are you doing with those assessment results? So there's a lot to unpack there. You know, in terms of assessment, we can also be looking at inclusion, you know, for example, in special education assessment, you know, that process, or gifted and talented. So there, you know, it's a really high stakes area, and we have to be very careful and inclusive of what we're doing with the assessment results.
The next one is instructional approaches. And you've kind of touched on that quite a bit,
mm-hmm.
In the beginning when we talked about, you know, what it's like to teach an L versus a non-L.
Right, yeah. So just, you know, and the purpose of having an EL master plan is really to promote equity. So when we're coming up with these plans, we have multiple meetings with stakeholders, mm-hmm. to determine what are the areas they'd like to focus on, and then getting the input, you know, in revisions from the stakeholders, having them look at pieces of the plan that we would co-author. So, and one of the pieces, of course, is the instructional approaches. And we want to make sure that we have ENL teacher voices who are helping develop the district policy as just kind of a, you know, a path forward for the district to take to ensure equity. And also in our plans, we look at, you know, we work with the district. Do you have a 3-year goal, a 5-year goal? You're not going to do everything at once. So what steps will you take each year? And how will you know if you're getting there?
Yeah. So, yeah, there's got to be a bit of a reflection there,
absolutely,
right? Throughout the process at every step,
right,
pretty much, right?
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So number 5 is staffing. And, you know, you touched on that already and how, you know, challenging it can be. But, you know, making sure that you have the right staff.
Right. The right staff, and also looking at how do you determine the percentage of staff. So, you know, in some districts, they don't have any kind of formula. A lot of districts do have a staffing formula that looks at the students, your English learners' proficiency level. And depending on the level, you might have a weighted formula. So if I have a lot of students at a lower level, then I might need more ENL teachers. And it's been kind of eye-opening that a lot of districts don't have a way to decide what kind of staff they're getting. Right. And they can allocate positions sometime at the building level, like, oh, I really need a reading specialist. But that's a huge area for advocacy, is to find out how are the decisions made in terms of hiring qualified ENL teachers and bilingual teachers.
Yeah. So, and making sure you have enough to, you know, to meet the the required minutes, because, you know, we have teachers that are, you know, going from, I know when I was teaching, I was going between 4 different buildings with 4 different schedules, an elementary schedule, a middle school schedule, and a high school schedule. So I know what that's like.
Oh yeah, being an itinerant teacher is, it's super challenging, right? So, I was, in my first teaching position in the U.S., I was offered an itinerant position. And thankfully, a non-itinerant position came up, and I took the one where I was based in one building. Yeah, because it's tough. You have to learn all the ins and outs of 4 different buildings in your case. Yeah.
4 different schedules, too.
Yeah, and 4 different administrators, 4 different principals.
Yep. And then evaluations are crazy, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, all right, so the next one on the list is access to other programs. Such as like CTE, Gifted and Talented, IB, those kinds of things. Can you expand a little bit?
Right. So you mentioned first CTE, so Career and Technical Education, which is something that is definitely growing, and I'm a big proponent of, and you know, in general, and also ensuring that we have representation of English learners in those programs. Are they aware of them? Yeah. Are the parents aware of them? You know, in the language and manner that they are, you know, most likely to understand. Are we encouraging kids that are interested to do them? Is transportation a barrier, for example? Scheduling, is that a barrier? Electives and getting credits. So we want to really ensure that they're getting access to programs like that. Also to advanced placement or AP programs, International Baccalaureate or IB. We really want to encourage our students to be in those courses, and also working with the teachers to ensure that they're using scaffolds and supports so our students can be successful. You know, the worst thing is for a student to end up in a program such as one of those and then sink or swim. You know, we want to really ensure that those teachers are using the supports, are modifying or, you know, scaffolding curriculum, for example, to give our students a chance for success.
Yeah, and are there even ENL teachers that are part of those CTE programs? Because, you know, if they're traveling to a different building or a different campus, there's a chance that they're, you know, there isn't that support.
Right. And that's, you know, another way, there's so many ways to advocate, but, you know, kind of finding out what's happening in my school and to what degree are L's there and to what degree do they have support to be able to be successful.
And for our listeners, could you just explain what IB or International Baccalaureate is?
Yeah. In layman's terms, because at my former high school where I taught, there was an IB program. Mm-hmm. So it is an international program, and stop me if I'm wrong. I know, you know, I can explain just in broad brush strokes.
Yeah.
So it's an international curriculum with assessments at the high school level. And it's very rigorous, but it's also very cross-curricular. and very much project-based. And it's a wonderful program. And if you have an IB diploma, it's recognized all over the world. So it's something, you know, it's very super rigorous, but also very rewarding, and something I would really advocate looking into. And I believe they're starting, you know, kind of funneling kids up now at the elementary level as well, kind of preparing them for IB coursework.
Yeah, it makes me think of the Seal Biliteracy also,
yeah,
which is very popular too.
Yeah, do you want to share about that?
Oh yeah, sure. So in New York State, we have a Seal Biliteracy program, and the student's junior year, they apply for this, and then they have to create a project and then present in their senior year, and they get a certain amount of points, and they get a special seal on their diplomas. And so it's a really great way to showcase the, you know, the asset of multilingualism,
yeah,
for students. We were just talking the other day. There's a student who I think presented in like four or five different languages.
Wow.
And we were just in awe of that.
Yeah.
So it's just amazing.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. So New York was, I believe, the second state after California. Mm-hmm. And now the movement, it's in most states across the U.S. now that they do have the CELA biliteracy at the state level. And a great thing Syracuse City Schools are doing is they have a program called Steps to the Seal. Mm-hmm. And we have a video about it in our book.
Yeah.
Video in the book. There's a QR code that you scan to see the video, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So they have a program where kids, they bring them in at the elementary level, get the parents interested, you know, make it really, you know, just a big celebration of what the students can do, celebrating the, you know, the home language and the literacy and culture, to then explain what the Seal of Biliteracy is, to just kind of prepare them to take these mini steps to get there, to be successful. And I love just, you know, the advocacy and the innovation that they show.
Right. And so, you know, connecting this back to leadership, right, we're sharing all of these things because these are ways to showcase, you know, assets of multilingual learners, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Great connection.
Yeah. Thanks. So the next one on the 10 keys for L master plans is progress monitoring. So could you kind of explain like how that's different than assessment?
Sure. You want to be looking at how are your L's doing? So in terms of, you know, gaining English proficiency and exit, how long are they staying in your programs, for example? Are there any long-term L's that you might want to be looking out for? You know, at what point do you see that they might be falling through the cracks or not making the progress that they're making? So just, you know, basically looking at how your students are progressing, mm-hmm, over time.
And then family and community engagement, we've talked a lot about,
yeah,
that and how important that is.
Right. So making sure that, you know, parents and families are an integral part of your programs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in some school districts, they have I think of Manassas City Schools in Virginia. They have a parent committee, so they meet with them once a month. They provide input on the programming, on, you know, any kind of community initiatives and school initiatives. So it's a great, with interpreters, it's a great way to really bring in the multilingual parents.
Awesome. Yeah, great. Thank you. And so the next one is professional development. So what role does professional development play in this whole process?
Yeah, it is a huge, huge role. And, you know, we always want to ensure that our teachers are constantly learning, and so are administrators. But we want to make sure that, you know, we're kind of targeting that learning. In terms of, you know, having a master plan and, you know, in being a leader, we want to hear our teachers' voices and also look to what our students need, what our parents say the needs are. So, you know, in terms of choosing topics for professional development, really having that be an organic process, coming from our students, our teachers. Also, of course, coming from administrators, to just have these conversations about what's needed and what's relevant and what is not, right? So that's very important. It's also important in professional development to give teachers a choice of what they'd like to do, what they'd like to work on, and also having them rise up as leaders and direct this professional development. So working at the school level, for example, or the grade level or content area level, to provide learning, having it be short and short snippets. Mm-hmm. We want to keep teachers in classrooms with their students. So a job-embedded PD is, you know, super important. And looking to other ways for professional development. For example, on Twitter right now, there are slow book chats. Like, I learn so much on Twitter, and it's free, and I can kind of do it. You know, I don't have to leave my classroom, for example. I can take a look on my, you know, later on my own time.
And there's also, you know, option of maybe doing like a PLC within your building, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, focus on one certain strategy and maybe even take a few minutes to visit your colleagues in their classrooms.
That's so key to have that time, that you mentioned, to go and look at what your colleagues are doing. Maybe, you know, see if there's a sub, or maybe your administrator, even better, could cover your class so you can see what your colleagues are doing.
Yeah.
So that's super critical.
Yeah, it's an important consideration, I think, to make sure that, you know, that teachers have that time.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
and in PD time, you know, it's super, very critical. For example, we're working with Montgomery County School District outside of D.C., which is a large school district, and we're making sure that teachers have adequate planning time, that when we're doing PD, that planning and the application of any research or strategies or tools takes place so they can apply what they're learning to their context and then use it the next day in instruction. Just so, you know, so it feels like it's worth their time. Teachers have, as we know, very little time, right? So, and just recognizing all of the strengths that they're bringing always and what a commitment it takes and, you know, to be a part of a PLC or professional development group.
Mm-hmm. So the very last key is program evaluation. So is there a process involved in that, or?
Yeah, there are, you know, different processes that can be involved in that. And oftentimes that's driven by what the district is looking at in terms of program evaluation. It can come up, you know, at different cycles or different cycles for an ESL program to be evaluated. So it would, you know, a lot of times the evaluation happens through an outside firm that might take a look at your data. They might conduct different kinds of interviews. But having a plan ahead to how you're going to be evaluating your program. We also always, you know, as teachers, as administrators and leaders, want to be continuously evaluating and reflecting on what we're doing to be able to always improve our practices.
So what additional resources might be available to do this work?
Lots of resources that are, you know, available. You know, you can go look on our support ed website, getsupported.net, to see what we have. We like to share. Most of our resources are free and downloadable and for the public to use and take and adapt. So having been a teacher and administrator, you're often found recreating the wheel. Mm-hmm. So I like to, you know, I'm a mom of three and I like to be really efficient. So it's also my philosophy, and what we create is for public consumption, that, you know, take it and use it, please.
So it kind of wrapping up, I'm thinking, if we have, you know, administrators that are trying to or thinking about making that first step, what are some first steps that administrators or building leaders could make?
In terms of leading and advocating?
Leading and advocating and just making sure that, you know, that the needs of their L's are being met.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the first step is to, you know, be humble and vulnerable and reach out to your teachers and find out what's going well and what's not going well, right? And just keeping it focused on the kids always, you know, as human beings. It's hard not to take things personally, but, you know, we have to look at, what am I doing well as a leader? What am I missing? You know, where are my blind spots? So to be able to improve and to have these conversations together, I think that's probably your first step, is just to listen to what's going on and to be ready to hear some things that might be a little bit uncomfortable.
Yes, a very wise woman told me to focus on intellectual humility.
Ooh,
so,
I like that.
Yeah, so I take that, I hold that with me.
Yeah.
So, well, this has been a great conversation. I really enjoyed, you know, talking about all of these, all this information, and I really appreciate your time, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening today. If you would like to learn more about the brilliant guest we had on today's episode or any of the resources we discussed, please visit the Mid-State Auburn webpage. This podcast is produced by Mid-State Auburn at OCM BOCES, and our theme music is Catalyst from Purple Planet Music. We hope that you'll tune in next time for more of Our Burning Questions.